on and perhaps some others.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you who else is really talking about this stuff, but we really don't have time. Give us a couple other, you know, who else do you think is really dealing with this stuff in a serious way?
Well, who else is dealing with this in a serious way? I think that the military is dealing with this in a serious way. I think the U.S. military is, but you know, we're not privy to any of that information. I think Peter Wadhams is in the United Kingdom is the ice expert, the Arctic ice expert. And
okay, I got to cut you off because we got to go. But that book Drawdown is the one you mentioned.
Yeah, Drawdown. Yeah, start with that
by
book.
Paul Hawken. Drawdown. Another Paul, three yeah. Pauls. Okay, thank you so much, Paul Beckwith, climate system scientist. Really appreciate and hope to get you back on again.
Yes.
Oh, and your website is paulbeckwith.net.
Yes, paulbeckwith.net, and I have hundreds of YouTube videos talking about everything.
Yes, thank you so much.
Just go to my YouTube channel. Yeah.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks. Goodbye, thanks.
Hello, KABU members. Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KABU Board of Directors is essential. Here's an opportunity for you to join the KABU Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all our members. Please consider applying to become a KABU Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There's a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KABU member. To apply, go to kabu.fm or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 17th, 2017. We are looking for folks who love KABU, who are committed to our community and want to carry forward KABU's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KABU needs you. Apply today.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Improvisation Summit of Portland, Friday, June 30th from 5 to 11 p.m. and Saturday, July 1st from 3 to midnight at Disjecta in Portland. The Improvisation Summit is an annual music and movement festival presented by the Creative Music Guild. This year, the summit features artists like Andrea Klein, Sage Fisher with Institute for Creative Dying and Andy Rayborn, Andrew Durkin's Breath of Fire, and many more performers and artists. Again, that's the Improvisation Summit of Portland, Friday, June 30th from 5 to 11 p.m. on Saturday, July 1st from 3 to midnight at Disjecta Contemporary Arts Center, 8371 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, it's 9:02. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on public affairs programming for Wednesday. At 9:30, Radio Zine presents Andrew Evans and his book, The Black Penguin, a memoir, travel tale, and love story that led him on a 12,000-mile journey. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia headlines interviews and commentary. And then at 10:15, The Bradcast breaks down this week's failure by the GOP to move forward with their health care bill. And then at 11 o'clock, we got the Recovery Zone, today speaking with Mark Beckoff, author of The Animals Agenda, Freedom, Compassion, and Coexistence in the Human Age. But first, we begin the morning with Intersections Radio, today welcoming Nina Diaz of the indie punk band Girl in a Coma to discuss her solo music, addiction, and healing. And we'll go straight ahead with that. Thanks for tuning into KABU this morning, and thank you for those of you who have become members. We really appreciate your generous support. And if you are just a listener and not a member, you can become one when you go to kabu.fm and click on donate. Thank you.
You're listening to Intersections Radio, the podcast where we geek out on all things intersectionality. I'm your host, Sarika Mehta. Welcome, and thanks for tuning in. Today is another exciting in-studio episode. Today, I'm in studio with rock star Nina Diaz.
Rockstar.
Nina Diaz hails from San Antonio, Texas. Nina Diaz is the lead singer of the indie punk band Girl in a Coma, and she's on tour for her debut solo album, The Beat is Dead. This album is an intense story of not just her solo journey, but of her experiences with addiction and substance abuse and eventually getting clean. She is performing here tonight in Portland and was kind enough to stop by and chat with me in studio. And she has her guitar, so we are in for a fun time today. This is Intersections Radio. Nina Diaz, welcome to Intersections Radio.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the debut solo album.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
And as I understand it, you got into professional music pretty young. You were a teenager.
I was 13.
13
is pretty young. I was 13 years old when I first started playing music. And I was 17 when we got signed to Black Heart Records, Joan Jett's record label.
Wow. So, well, as a teenager, I mean, that's your childhood. What was that experience like?
Messy, intense, and very much on the up and up. There's anytime there was a dull moment, I would go crazy because I was just getting so used to being out there and going and hanging out with an older crowd. And when anybody, no matter what you do, if it's in music or art or whatever, if you're surrounded by older people, you're going to get into older things sooner than maybe you should. And I experienced a lot of that really fast. But I'm glad that I did, in a way, because I got it out of my system. So now I can talk about how dark I allowed myself to go. So maybe I can help people that are teenagers or trying to get out of it, no matter what age they are. And I can be very open about my story because I started so young, you know. But there's a lot of musicians out there that have started young, and they didn't get tainted or whatever by drugs or alcohol or anything or the business, and that's cool. But it just so happens in my story that it did go down a different kind of path. A lot of great things, but also a lot of crazy stuff too.
Right. I mean, I'm sorry for everything negative that you've experienced.
It's not your fault. It's that kind of thing. I don't regret anything because I learned from it. And I know that's cliche, but if I were to regret anything, it would be that while I was going through the stuff I was doing, I wasn't very mindful and present. That's the thing that I regret, is there's some things that happened that I wasn't very present for, and I'm trying to make up for that stuff now.
In my head, I'm thinking you are really young, mm-hmm. so to be present in these experiences would be challenging. I mean, you're still, your brain is still developing.
Yeah, right?
And your judgment.
It's true. Like, and it's funny because I've just always been an overthinker ever since I was little, and I always had journals, and I would always write stories. And when I started playing guitar, Fani, my sister, the drummer and Girl in a Coma, taught me guitar, and it came very naturally to me. And as I started to experience things, I just naturally took to it, you know. And I think that in teenagers, like you said, in general, you're still learning where you fit in. You're learning what group you're supposed to be in, or who you are, and what you want to do with your life. And mine kind of was laid out for me. And when I started drinking and doing drugs and stuff, I feel like my brain stopped developing the social skills that you're supposed to develop, you know, as a teenager and stuff. And now, I'm 4 years sober and clean, I feel like I've picked up where I last left off as far as the social stuff goes, because I'm a very awkward person, I feel like, sometimes, and can get really bad anxiety. But I'm allowing myself to heal from the things that I didn't quite let myself develop when I was supposed to develop them now.
Well, congratulations on being clean for 4 years.
Thank you.
I know that couldn't have been easy, and that's awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
And I appreciate that you're letting yourself heal, like you said, from wherever you left off. This is your debut solo album, but you're still with Girl in a Coma.
Yeah, we're still together.
So I guess maybe explain how that was working out.
So, been in Girl in a Coma for half my life, starting when I was 13. There's an 8-year gap between me and the girls, which, again, I'm surrounded by older people all the time, so I kind of naturally just fit in. And I mean, I was mature for my age, but I was still very immature at the same time. And, you know, after getting signed when I was 17, and we recorded like 4 albums, and in that span, I'm starting to know myself and go through the things I'm going through, and so are the girls. They're going through their own things. And I had relapsed really badly 4 years ago, and it was months of using, and it was the worst that I've ever relapsed. You know, I've been on and off drugs since I was 13, really. And it just really broke me to the point where if I continued doing what I was doing, I would end up losing everyone or end up dead. You know, I'm surprised that I made it, actually. You know, because if you see pictures of me from 2012 and in the beginning of 2013, I was like 111 pounds. And like, I just didn't look very good. And the other thing is, though, I was a functioning addict to a point where I could play, I could write, I could tour. Even though after the shows, I was exhausted, you know, but I'd still push on and I could still create, which is a good and a bad thing, you know, because then you realize, oh, I can still do what I need to do. Mm-hmm. But I was creating these new batch of songs that wasn't necessarily a girl in a coma sound. That even when we started, we were never like, we're going to be this kind of band or that mm-hmm. kind of band. It just kind of formed into this punk rock alternative kind of sound with all of our different influences. But there was this bulk of music I was writing, the drums and the bass and the guitar and having synth in it, because in the beginning of the solo record, I was still using. And those people out there that have done drugs and stuff, you know that it can make you just want to work all night long and do all these crazy things. But there was some life happening there. And as life was happening in these new batch of songs, it was almost like death was happening to me because I was using, you know, I was sick. But finally, something just happened in the universe where I got caught. It had to just be laid out in the open that I am on drugs and I need to stop. And part of what helped me in my recovery, very much so in the beginning, was knowing that these batch of songs, because music is therapy. It is therapy. Mm-hmm. And it does help heal you in many ways. And I needed to find myself as my own musician, my own person, my own identity away from the girls. I felt like that was a big part of not to blame them at all for me using, but, you know, a lot of stuff happened very fast than a lot of normal teenage women go through, and I just needed a break. And it just so happens again that these batch of songs, I did not want to force them to play something where I wrote everything, because Girl in a Coma is like a group effort, mm-hmm. you know. And at first it was a little bumpy, but now it seems like it's the best thing that we could have done for us. I think if we had carried on and I was using, we would have ended up breaking up, or I would have ended up dead or something, you know. And now, because we've taken this break, we've learned to appreciate each other a lot more now.
It's a very positive break, and it is allowing you to find yourself as well.
Yeah, now it is.
The song I would like to hear first from you is January 9th. It's called January 9th, and it's to do with influence from your grandmother.
Yeah. January 9th, 1998, my grandmother passed away. It was, you know, as graceful as a death as could be, but I was very close to my grandparents, and I think in the Latino like community, the family, you are really close to your grandparents, I feel like, you know. And it hurt when she passed. I was like 10 years old when she passed. And I could always feel her around, though. And then my grandfather passed a couple years later. And as I was using, there was this small percentage of something positive around me. And I felt like it was my grandmother and my grandfather kind of trying to help me in the way that they can, by letting me know that they are there and their energy is there. And this one night, I was working on this song and I was just playing this little lick like over and over, and then I started to build on it and I wrote a good chunk of this song. But I felt so much of an energy around me that it scared me. But I think it was my grandmother. And at the end of the night, I realized what day it was, and it was January 9th. So I thought, oh, well, I'm going to call this song January 9th.
Can we hear it from you?
Yeah. Here we go.
Thank you.
Every time I try to find another place to stay, every time I try to look away, it seems to cave. Oh, in the back of my mind, in the back of my mind, every time I try to look away, I scream your name. Every time I try to walk away, I still the same. Oh, in the back of my mind, in the back of my mind, I don't wanna be the bad one. I wanna be the sad one that you find.
Powerful. That's a powerful song.
Thank you.
And you're telling the story. Well, you're telling your whole story about addiction and recovery and coming clean in the whole album. What does it feel like to perform something so intense and personal for a room full of strangers, a lot of people?
I like it. I like it because, you know, when I'm off the stage, I can be kind of awkward and hair in my face, kind of keep to myself. And only the people that are really close to me, they know all the different sides to me and the goofy side and everything like that. But there's that performer in me too. And I turn it on when I'm on stage. And lyrics, the fact that this is an album that I was very open about what I was going through. And if anybody asks specifically, hey, what did you write this about? I will tell them. And when I sing them, sometimes there's a line, now that the record's out, now that people are getting to know it, and I'll catch someone in the audience singing the line along with me, and it makes me excited to know that they get it. You know, this is helping them in some way, in a way that it's supposed to help them. And then I think, oh no, they're singing along, and then it makes me overthink things really quick of like, they actually know the lyrics now, you know, because there's such a big gap of people not knowing anything. You know, I knew them because I was playing them for so long, mm-hmm. but it was all new to everybody else. And now that they're starting to catch on, it's exciting, but then it's another transition of understanding, like my mind understanding and getting that they're getting it now, you know. And it's not scary to do it, because again, that I feel like that's my time to let everything out and worry so much about what any consequences can be while I'm on the stage.
It sounds like it's exciting, but also overwhelming.
Yeah, it's only overwhelming when I start to overthink things.
Yeah.
That's when it gets overwhelming. I'm looking forward to, you know, the other day in Long Beach, this one woman grabbed my arm while I was singing. And I'm actually looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to that part where anybody feels like the energy that we can share between each other while I'm on that stage performing. Like, that's what I'm excited about.
There are just a lot of great tracks. I love the different musical styles that you mix in, from Trick Candle to Rebirth, Fall in Love, and both versions of Morticians, Musicians. Do you have a song that's your favorite?
I like Singing for You. I like to perform Screaming Without a Sound. I like to run out into the audience and stuff and try to dance with them and try to make somebody feel awkward.
Oh.
Really quick. Like, so one time someone was on their phone texting and I got right up next to them and touched their phone and they looked at me like, huh? But I like to do that.
Do you always look for the person who's on their phone or just anyone who looks
shy?
When
I'm in a mischievous mood, I will look for the person and make them stick out and mess with their phone. Because again, there's
good
no consequences
you.
When you're yes. up there. I feel no consequences there, but then as soon as I'm off, then I get it.
I like that. I like that you call people out on their inappropriate behavior.
Yes, yes.
So speaking of your musical styles, I was thinking about, for one thing, you know, Girl in a Coma has a cover of Si Una Vez by Selena. Mm-hmm. And on this show, one of the things I inevitably talk a lot about is language and language justice. So, and this album, you actually have that song For You that you were talking about. Yeah. You have it in English and Spanish with the same musical composition.
Yes.
What inspired that?
Well, being Latina, I feel like I come from a generation that didn't really pay too much attention in Spanish class. You know, like, you know, and our generation, and they used to get after you if you spoke Spanish in school. And then now it's all about speaking Spanish. Like, it's like one way or the other. And in my household, there's Spanish around. My grandparents spoke Spanish. My grandmother only spoke Spanish. My mother and dad, you know, they still speak Spanish and they talk to each other and they talk about me when in front of my face because they know I can't really understand it, you know. But especially in Girl in a Coma, we got kind of branded as, y'all are representing the gay community, you're representing the Latino community, you're representing women, you like all these different things.
A lot of labels
happened to come upon us because of who we are, who mm-hmm. we were together. And I think we would pick and choose what we would actually stand behind. And of course, being Latina and being a woman and a strong woman is something that I definitely stand behind. And I can feel, though, the pressure of having the last name Diaz.
Yeah.
And automatically thinking, people think, oh, you speak Spanish. Mm-hmm. You will perform music in Spanish, right? You know, like that, as if that's an automatic thing that you have to do. And I'm not saying anything against it because there's no anger as far as, like, I'm not trying to be lazy about it. It just happens that majority of the music I listen to is English, and I just started singing and writing in English. I would love to eventually gravitate towards doing more music in Spanish, which is why, you know, when we were doing this, my solo record, I came up with the idea of, I would like to do For You in Spanish. I just feel that, you know, your intuition can tell you something, and I feel like I need to get more on top of it for me, for my culture, because I would like to go to Mexico and be able to carry conversations and sing my songs that I've written original music in Spanish. You know, I would like to do that. So when we were doing the album, I thought it would be nice to do it in Spanish. So when we do release like a single of it or the video, we can do a Spanish, you know, version, because I'd like to be able to go Both ways,
yeah. Absolutely. That makes complete sense, and I do understand the pressure of having a certain last name and the expectations that are on you. And it cuts both ways, you know, when when your language has been taken away as a child, because yeah. the world around you was really pressuring English and assimilation.
Exactly.
So I was reading this article about an artist who he has decided to sing in Spanish as a political act in Trump's America. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've never was a political person. I mean, when I write, I wouldn't really write anything political. It'd be more of just stories and just me being an emotional person. But, of course, with Trump, I don't agree. You know, of course, that's a given. And it makes me angry, a lot of the things that I read and I see. I could just... It's like, where does it begin? Like, where do I begin?
You know, yeah,
where
do I we begin all feel to? That way.
Exactly. It's like, I want to help so much. But I think the best thing I could do to help is to continue to be a strong woman and to learn Spanish. Like, that would be good, you know, just for me, too. Because I get that. But the first thing I know I can do against what Trump is and what he stands for is just being a strong woman to begin with.
I like that you're empowered to be more of yourself to fight this. Well, as I had mentioned before, I would love to hear the song for you, from you, and in whichever language you like. It's up to you.
I'm going to do English.
All right.
Because I need to practice with
Spanish. Sure, no problem.
Okay. For what you need.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Nina Diaz, thank you so much for joining me on Intersections Radio and for the acoustic mini concert.
Yeah, of course. Anytime. Thank you for having me.
That was my guest, Nina Diaz. Her debut solo album is called The Beat Is Dead. To listen to the podcast of this interview, check out intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. Visit the same website for previous episodes of this podcast and join the Facebook community at facebook.com/intersectionsradio. You're listening to Intersections Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
And next on KABU, we go to Radio Zane presenting Andrew Evans and his book, The Black Penguin. Stay tuned.
We are lucky to be joined in the studio today by Andrew Evans. He is a travel writer and has come out with the book, The Black Penguin, about his journey to Antarctica by bus. From Washington, D.C. to Antarctica. Welcome to KABU, Andrew.
Thank you.
This, I think, something that many people have dreamed of is traveling overland to Antarctica, or I know I have. And you managed to make it happen with National Geographic. How did you convince them to give you the support to take this trip?
I'm still not sure how it happened or how I got away with it. But it is the first chapter of my book in The Black Penguin is pitching my editor there and telling him my plan. I think Antarctica had always been so elusive to me as a destination, and I had tried to get there and failed so many times that I think I was just desperate. And I said, you know, when I looked at a map, I figured Antarctica was elusive, but 90% of the way there had roads on it. There were buses, there was public transportation. And public transportation is something I had access to. So I just said, this is what I'm going to do. And I would have done it regardless, but when I pitched it to my editor, he liked the idea and he gave me his blessing.
And this was a social media exercise as well. It was kind of in the early days of Twitter.
Exactly. Twitter was very new, and I had been behind the trend on a lot of social media, but Twitter, for whatever reason, I jumped right on. And I think as a writer, it was exciting to me to report live from the field. So I said, you know, this is a story that I'm not going to write in the past tense. I'm going to write in the present tense, live tweet it, not knowing where I'm going to be each day.
And how did that go for you, tweeting every day? I know at some point when you were in somewhere along the coast of Peru, you were saying how you had turned your entire trip into a vaudeville act and you were had lost your dance to perform for your many followers every single day.
Yeah, and I think it was an awakening in some sense of what media has become. I think we're still dealing with that today. And every day, the speed, the tempo at which we're producing media and digesting it is faster and faster. And I felt that because I felt I was in these beautiful places traveling at a very slow speed, but being able to report everything. And at some point, you have to scratch your head and say, well, you know, what are we really doing here? It's a chicken and egg sort of thing. Are we performing for social media, or are we using social media to report on real life? I still struggle with that today.
Hmm. We'll talk more about your journey to Antarctica, but I want to get a little bit into your background as a person, how you came into the kind of writing that you do. You've traveled to many places in the world and written as a travel writer, but you grew up a devout young Mormon in Ohio, and had kind of the whole thing planned out, your mission, your travel to Brigham Young University. What happened?
I definitely took a left turn somewhere. You know, I was born into a very, you know, Orthodox Mormon family. I'm seventh generation Mormon. So it was a huge part of our identity. It consumes your whole life, all of your decisions, how you spend all your free time, your weekends at church, your church activities, everything. And in a lot of ways, it was a wonderful way to grow up. A lot of love, a very secure home. But it's also, you know, very precise. There's a lot of expectations. There's definitely expectations and not a lot of wiggle room in terms of what you want to do in life. And for me, I knew early on that was going to be a problem. Most of all, with my sexuality, as a young gay man, knowing that who I was in direct conflict with the mission of the Mormon Church, I saw that as being problematic. And I stalled for as long as I could, but then eventually that came to a head.
Well, and it's the kind of situation that drives some teenagers to suicide. I mean, the statistics are extremely high of young religious youth and teenagers that are raised in religious families that are unsure about coming out to their families and are pushed to extremes. I mean, is that something you experienced in your family?
Yes, yes. And I think the reason I felt the need to put this in the book was because we're still there. You know, this is something I dealt with as a child in the 80s, but here we are in 2017, and LGBTQ youth are still at risk, higher than ever before. When I hear stories about people like Tyler Clementi, who jumped off the George Washington Bridge in New York City at the age of 18, very talented violinist who just felt he didn't belong, there was no place for him in this world. And I think religions, for all the good they may think they're doing, the message that they're giving to our youth is that there's not a place for them, that they're broken, that they're wrong, and these very young and supple minds believe it. They believe that it's better for them to be dead than to live their lives. And to me, that's a tragedy.
Well, and here in Portland, the proportion of youth that live on the streets that are gay and lesbian and trans is much higher, you know, than the general population because of kids getting kicked out of their homes for the most part and feeling like they need to run away because they have no support in their homes.
I think this is a huge problem across the United States. I witnessed it when I was a college student in Utah. At this point, I was independent. You know, I had a dorm. I was a student. But I would go to some of these all-night cafes, and you would see kids, 14, 15, 16, LGBT, you know, homeless, who'd been kicked out of their homes or just didn't feel safe in their homes. And they would go to Denny's to spend the night. And, you know, people weren't calling it homelessness back then, but that's exactly what it was, and at risk, and then everything that comes with that. So I think it's something we're still dealing with, and we're not addressing the problem.
So in Utah, did you end up going to Brigham Young?
I did. And in fact, I am a BYU graduate, which is a miracle that I made it all the way through because I almost got kicked out several times.
Were you out in college?
I came out while I was in college.
And is that, I mean, I would assume that's pretty unusual at BYU, being the Mormon university.
It is, and at the time, it was against the regulations to even identify as gay. I think now they have some kind of gray, nuanced approach where they're saying you can say you're gay, but you can't be gay, which means anything. So it could be something you wear, you know, it could be holding hands with someone of the same sex. So it's definitely problematic, and I think a lot of gay people at BYU purposefully stay closeted until they graduate.
So you went through that whole experience of being at the Mormon University, and at some point did you end up having some sort of cut with your family? Did you sever ties, or did you manage to stay connected with the family?
It's problematic because I think what outsiders don't understand about Mormonism is there really isn't a difference between your family and the church. So the institution, the religious beliefs, and your family group are all one and the same. So when I began to have problems with the church, it immediately interpreted as problems with my family. And there was a time where I was formally told not to come home anymore. It was a distinct break with my family. I think it was a tragedy for my parents. They saw me as leaving them. I saw them as, you know, rejecting me. And there were many years where my siblings and parents, I had zero contact with them. As a Mormon, your whole life is laid out in front of you, and suddenly that blueprint had been ripped from me, and it was this blank space. And that was difficult, but it was also great because it allowed me to kind of rebuild my life from scratch. And so a lot of my travels, you know, we talk about this trope of finding yourself, but in wandering the globe, I could kind of build my life and say, this is who I am, and I've found a lot of joy in that.
And just to talk a little bit about your other books prior to this new book, The Black Penguin, where are some of the places that you traveled? You went to Iceland?
Yeah, and I wrote a guidebook to Iceland. I've been traveling there for 20 years, and I wrote my guidebook to it about 12 years ago. Now it's become very much a popular mainstream destination, but when I was traveling there, it was still pretty undiscovered for most Americans. I love Iceland. I still go back one or two times a year. And actually, my fourth edition of my Iceland guidebook is about to come out. So that was great. I wrote a guidebook to Ukraine as well, because I had been a Mormon missionary in Ukraine, and mine was the first English language guidebook to the country. So that was an amazing enterprise. I wrote a vegetarian guide to Washington, D.C., which was also fun and challenging as well.
And you have little snippets of some of your other travels in The Black Penguin. This story about the rabbi in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could tell a little bit about that experience for our listeners.
Sure. It actually kind of began as a joke, because my friend in Seattle, who is Jewish, made this joke towards me that my Hasidic Jews are my spirit animal, because no matter where I go in the world, I seem to run into, sometimes in very remote places, these very devout Hasidic Jews. And this particular case, I was researching my guide to Ukraine. So I was writing about the history. And what most people don't understand is that the history of Ukraine is very much the history of Judaism as well. You know, the Jews have been living there for over 1,000 years. And I was particularly interested in the history of Hasidism, because the Baal Shem Tov, who is the founder of Hasidism, lived there. He taught there. A lot of his teachings that became his writings were based on his own explorations in the mountains of Western Ukraine. And he's buried there. So I went to his grave to write about it as a destination. And I ended up spending the day with this really wonderful rabbi, very kind. But it was an interesting experience, because I was drawing away from my own religion, and suddenly I was with someone who was very devout, and being caught in this awkward position of knowing how much do I show of myself in order to befriend him and learn about his faith and his history and culture, but also being afraid of being judged by him.
Mm. Well, and you made up a fictional wife, and had the whole conversation about why you haven't had children, and it seems like there's that kind of hidden aspect to being gay on the road. Is that something you ran into a lot? Did you have to make up a wife in many occasions?
I'm not proud of that. I mean, it was difficult to even confess and put on the page that I had done something like that. But I think every queer traveler deals with this to some extent, because there's so many expectations and the cultural differences in other parts of the world. I think women travelers deal with this all the time, about what they should or shouldn't be doing when they're in another country. To be honest, that's the only time I've ever really done that, where I've made up a fake wife. And now I think I'm a little prouder of who I am and more confident. So I just returned from the Middle East in the Arab world, where people would ask me, and I didn't keep it a secret. You know, even in very homophobic Arab countries, I would make it clear that I'm married to a man. So part of this book is showing my own journey and coming to terms with who I am and not being afraid to say it.
But you don't want to call yourself a gay travel writer. You said you have some issues with that kind of terminology.
I do, because I never was a gay writer. From day one, being gay is how other people label my sexual identity. It's who I am, but it's not part of my work. And I take my writing very seriously. Everything I've published in the last 20 years has been about travel, and it's been writing for the sake of writing. And so the journey of this book was interesting, because the minute, the first few times I wrote drafts, there was none of that personal stuff in it. When I started putting it in, I was immediately sequestered to, this very small and remote gay corner. And I think, honestly, it's like that in every creative enterprise. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I imagine you don't call yourself a woman producer. You're a producer. And I think that when we put these labels, these caveats, especially when it's almost like a congratulations, you're a gay travel writer. I also take issue with that, and I Even now, the book is being marketed as a gay book. If that helps people, that's great. But that was not what I set out to do when I wrote it.
Mm. Well, and as somebody who is traveling the world as appearing as a white male, there is some amount of privilege. Like, you can hide the fact that you're gay, whereas somebody who's trans, for instance, is sometimes harder. Do you have advice for people who are traveling in some of the places that you've traveled as somebody who is genderqueer or not as conforming?
Yeah, I do. I think you bring up a very good point. And I've talked to my sisters about this because they'll say, oh, you get to do all these things, but if you're a woman, you wouldn't be able to. And they're right. We're going to have very different experiences on the road. My advice, and something I keep learning over and over again, is find your allies. Because no matter where you go in the world, no matter what kind of oppressive culture or judgment or whatever's there, there will be allies. I'm amazed by the universality of the world. Wherever I travel, the more I see we have in common. So trans people, for instance, who may feel very alone or apart growing up in Nebraska, if they go to Polynesia, if they go to Alaska, if they go to the Navajo Reservation, they go to South Asia, there are trans communities in all these places that are based on traditions that are thousands of years old. Trans people are everywhere. They've always been there. And so find your community, find your allies. I believe less and less in hiding who we are. And I've learned that from straight friends who've said, you know, it's better for you to, you know, in the Middle East, I've been told, you know, tell people who you are. They need to hear. They need to learn about the outside world. Now, again, that's easy for me to say as a tall white male because trans people face a level of violence that I think nobody else in our community does. But again, if you find your allies, a lot of cities now have LGBTQ centers. And this is a great invitation into a place, and suddenly you will have a family. Suddenly you'll have a support group that understands who you are.
Mm-hmm.
This was an important trip for me because it was one of the first trips when I was on assignment for National Geographic where I didn't hide who I was, what I would tell people. And I remember in Colombia arriving in Cartagena and being intimidated because people had, you know, really scared me with stories of violence. And, you know, I saw a rainbow flag and that it was like this beacon, and I walked towards it and there was a gay hotel, and there's this immediate understanding. You know, the guy behind the counter was gay. He knew I was gay. And, you know, we immediately had this connection. We could talk and I felt safe there. And I ended up staying in the gay hotel. And there was a violent incident that evening, but it was at another hotel, not the one that I was staying at. So that's another thing. Like, look for the rainbow flag. It does actually mean something. It's not just a marketing tool for McDonald's during the month of June.
Yeah. One thing I have to ask you, as somebody who has considered overland trip, it was, you know, probably 2 decades ago that I was mapping out a route, and there was the Darien Gap. And I wondered, is that still an issue? And were you able? How were you able to cross that section?
It's definitely still an issue. I'm glad you brought it up. In the end, I flew over it, which is not what I wanted to do at all. I set out with very strict rules. I was a purist. I had to travel overland. A few years prior to my being there, one of our other writers at National Geographic had been kidnapped in the Darien Gap during his attempt to cross it overland. And for those who don't know, the Darien Gap is about, I'd say, a 70-mile swamp between the Pan American Highway that ends in Panama and the one that begins in South America and Colombia. So people believe there's a road that goes from Alaska to the bottom of the world, but there isn't. There's this break. And it stayed that way on purpose for many reasons. The geography is very complicated, but also the political situation. You know, there's a reason it's this no man's land. But it is currently, you know, partially inhabited by a lot of narco-terrorists, guerrillas, people who are hiding out that have been known to be kidnapped people, to kill people. And so it's a problem. And after he'd been kidnapped and the State Department got involved, ransoms were paid, my editor specifically asked me not to attempt to cross. Plus, I really didn't have the time to attempt to hike across. So I tried to find a boat, and that was also difficult because of the season, the winds. There's a lot of drug running that was going on that I didn't want to get involved in. So in the end, for the sake of the journey and the story I was writing, I flew. But in order to fly, I had to backtrack. So I had to go back to Panama City and fly to the north of Colombia. So even though I was flying to South America, I was flying north, and it was about a 20-minute flight. And then I could pick the road up again and head south.
And you did this through National Geographic. Was it your first time working with them?
No, I'd worked for them before. In fact, I'd been writing for them for a couple years beforehand. And, you know, it was a very slow entry. I'd worked for them doing small things and slightly larger, and I'd written in the magazine. But this was my first, this became my first feature piece for the magazine.
Mm-hmm. You said that growing up in Ohio, National Geographic gave you this kind of look into another world. Did you ever have issues with the kind of historical role of National Geographic in exoticizing the other, and this kind of colonial outlook, creating the spectacle of the other? Is that something that came up for you?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I don't think I was aware of it as a 10-year-old reading National Geographic. It was presenting a picture of the world for me that was exciting. And, you know, I didn't think I had a critical enough mind at that point to recognize that it was a certain view of the world. I think I began to understand better the more travel writing I read, because I love the golden age of explorers around the turn of the last century. And these were women and men who were traveling to really remote places and writing incredible stories. And I love reading these diaries of the early explorers. But as an adult, when you read them, you realize that, you know, they're seeing it through the lens of their home countries. Everything is being compared, usually to 19th century England. So you're reading a writer's vision of India, but comparing it to the green hills of the Cotswolds in England. And they're saying, you know, this isn't as green as England. And that's problematic. But also I remember just the question of the human body and nudity, because National Geographic was notorious for showing these very exotic, bodies, female bodies, brown bodies, because that was the unwritten rule. You know, as long as it was brown, you could show it naked, but if it was white, you couldn't, which in and of itself deserves several doctoral theses to understand, you know, what is this about? But the kind of strange body modifications, tattoos, everything else, there was this view of exoticism. And I touch on it lightly in my book because, for me, one of the most exciting issues of National Geographic was the 1989 July issue, because there were two pictures that were published of white male nudes in France. So this, to me, you know, as a gay teenager, you know, this was very exciting, but it also showed a turn away and showed a new exoticism, and I think in a way turning the lens on ourselves.
And I wonder how many subscriptions were canceled from Middle America on that issue.
Probably. I mean, we're hugely hypocritical in America when it comes to the human form. But for generations, the exoticism was okay. And even now, I think they still haven't figured out what that means and the correct approach today. And it's a privilege to take images of other people, and there is a responsibility that comes with it. And I think the whole world has seen the rest of the world through these lenses of National Geographic. And to some degree, we're still paying the price for that.
Well, we haven't had any time to hear you actually read something from the book, but maybe we could end with if you have a favorite passage or something.
Sure. I'm going to read a quick passage from my journey on this bus that I took to Antarctica when I crossed into Bolivia. It was during the rainy season, so we had a lot of flooding. A lot of the roads were washed out. Travel became very difficult. And I definitely felt my own sense of privilege because I had purchased a ticket. I was sitting on the bus. I was the only foreigner. And I remember there was a very elderly man. He had to be in his late 70s, who had gotten on the bus and was actually asleep at my feet on the floor of this very rickety old bus, and me feeling absolutely horrible, knowing that I couldn't trade places with him. There's no way I could spend the night on the floor of the bus and sitting there, and then our bus going off the road, almost rolling, and being stuck in the mud in freezing cold high plains of Bolivia. So I'll just read this excerpt. Is that okay? "Todos empuje," shouted the bus driver, tapping me on the shoulder. It was 2 o'clock in the morning and the rain had stopped. Our bus had stopped too, and we were leaning dangerously to one side. Clear moonlight lit up the landscape, and one by one, we jumped from the last hanging step and into the mud. The bus had gone off the side of the road and tumbled into a shallow ditch. The front tires had sunk halfway into the wet mud, and by the spray of dirt that covered the window, it was clear the driver had already tried and failed to reverse the bus. Now he was the comandante, barking orders to a dozen of us, all men. We all pushed and pushed, rocking the bus in the mud, but without budging it an inch. "This is not going to work," I said out loud, in English. But we all kept pushing until the bus driver said it to us in Spanish, as if it were our fault. "This is not going to work." I said nothing, but went about searching for sticks and stones to lay behind the tires. The mud was too soft to steer through. We needed traction. Using my bare hands, I dug into the mud, pulling out clods of earth, and then packing the ground with rocks. We all worked together. The old man who was at my feet was now by my side, rolling boulders uphill and then dropping them into the hole. I was shivering in the piercing cold, soaked through and through, coated in mud and praying to the clear night sky, spattered with white stars. "God, please get us out of here." For 2 straight hours we worked, digging around the huge wheels and packing the dirt with anything we could find. The other passengers chipped in, bringing us bundles of twigs and grass or bits of cardboard. When it came time to push, I felt a swarm of hands pushing me from behind. The engine revved and then caught. Inch by inch, the bus moved backward, uphill, slowly lurching over the muddy shoulder and then back onto the road. We all cheered. "Yes!" I yelled out. Some of the men, as muddy as me, came to shake my hand. They said nothing but nodded their approval. "Bravo el gringo!" shouted one of the ladies, who handed me a scarf to clean my hands. Unlike the previous night, I was now the only foreigner on the bus, and I basked in the approval of my new Bolivian friends. A shared triumph makes a forever bond, and though I would never see any of these people again, we'd beat the odds and rolled our bus out of the mud. A broken-down bus was no more than a night of adventure for me, but for them, this was a way of life. Less than 10% of Bolivia's roads are paved, and the rainy season can shut down whole regions for weeks at a time. 9-hour bus rides turn into 15-hour bus rides. Buses wash into rivers or fall off deadly cliffs. Every year, hundreds of Bolivians perish in bus accidents, but we had escaped those statistics. Instead, we greeted the morning, dirty and exhausted, glad to reach the quiet border intact. I bid farewell to my new friends and shook hands with the driver, who thanked me and wished me buen viaje. Dripping a trail of raindrops behind me, I squished through the streets of Villazón in my soaking boots, and when I arrived at Argentinian customs, sunburned and salty, my face was still painted with the red mud of Bolivia.
I don't know if that will get people on the road to Bolivia or discourage them from traveling there, but what an experience.
It was. You know, it's a great way to travel. I felt like it definitely changed my view about the way that we travel, that so many of us travel without thinking about what goes into it. And when you suddenly, when your life depends on you pushing a bus out of the mud in the middle of the night, it changes how you see what we're doing for fun and what we're doing for necessity.
So. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Evans. He is the author of The Black Penguin, about his epic journey to Antarctica, 12,000-mile journey by bus from Washington, D.C. to Antarctica. Again, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on KBOO.
Thank you so much.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.